This is the Taylor Report, and I believe we have Stephen Gowans on the line. Are you there, Stephen?
Yes, I am. Hello, Phil.
And it's gowans.wordpress.com, What's Left. And Stephen, your book is coming out sometime soon, and it couldn't be more timely, assuming we get to that, we survive the present episode. The title of your book is Patriots, Traitors, and Empires, the story of Korea's fight for freedom. When people think of this crisis at the moment, this idea that Korea has fought for its freedom and that that struggle that somewhat it might have involved traitors and such. Tell us where you begin. If I got the date right, you said that the current modern crisis of Korea began in 1905. Is that roughly correct?
Yeah, 1905 is the year that Japan, or the Japanese Empire, declared a protectorate over Korea, and then 5 years later integrated Korea into its empire. And yes, the Koreans have been fighting for their freedom from two empires ever since, the Japanese and the U.S. Empire.
As I was reading your recent summary of the book at your website, and it's gowans.wordpress.com, please go there, I was hearing echoes in the back of my head of the course of the French Empire and what was called French Indochina. And these are almost of a piece. Was it not? At the end of World War II, the issue came up, are they going to have self-determination or do they return to the old imperial fold? And the Vietnamese resisted and other people in South Asia resisted. We're now seeing the Ken Burns thing where he's telling the story of how America got involved. But first America tried to save the French, and then the French had to go and the Americans decided to hang on to Vietnam. But in parallel, they were doing the same in Korea, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, there are great parallels between the two. I mean, both were divided, Korea and Vietnam. Of course, Korea remains divided, and Vietnam managed to achieve its independence. But they are very similar, yes. I mean, U.S. troops arrived on the Korean Peninsula about a month after the Japanese surrendered. And during that month, Koreans managed to drive Japanese out of administrative positions and collaborators as well, and to start taking their own affairs in their hands. 2 days before the Americans swaggered onto the peninsula, the Koreans declared their own government, the Korean People's Republic. And the United States arrived 2 days later and said that it would not recognize the republic and essentially went to war against it and conducted a war for quite a number of years. There was a major guerrilla war that went on in the south of Korea, which the United States tried to suppress. And it tried to suppress it with a military that it recruited, and it recruited from collaborators with the Japanese. Many of the officer corps had been in the Japanese Imperial Army.
Yes. By the way, we do have amnesia, right? People do not remember all these things or even think about them. But I know in Vietnam the story. Ho Chi Minh did the same thing, right? He declared, "Okay, now we are a new country." And a unified one, and they said no, you're not. But I think in the case of Indochina, the French recruited the Japanese to help them keep down the Vietnamese. Did a similar thing happen in Korea?
For a few months, the Americans brought the Japanese back, but they quickly got rid of them and replaced them with Koreans who had collaborated with the Japanese, so essentially the same. I mean, Koreans who had been in the Japanese Imperial Army or who had been in the Korean Colonial Police under Japanese command, these are the people that the U.S. allied with. And the reason they allied with them is that the United States recognized very early on that if left to their own devices, the Koreans would create a communist state. Mm-hmm. They knew that's the direction in which Koreans wanted to go. They looked to the Soviet Union for direction. It was going to be a leftist, a socialist, indeed a communist country. And the Soviets and the Americans were both on the peninsula. They'd agreed that they were going to divide the peninsula in order to accept the Japanese surrender. But the agreement was that they would leave within 5 years. And within 5 years, there would be elections for a national government. But the United States recognized that Kim Il-sung, who became the founder of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or North Korea, that he would almost certainly win that election. The same thing happened in Vietnam as well, where the Americans realized that the communists would win the election. So, and they did the same thing. I mean, so they maneuvered to politically partition the peninsula to establish a puppet state in order to preempt the national elections, which would inevitably lead to a communist government.
And to, speaking of the credentials of the fighters and why they would have won an election likely, they had been the allies of the allies who fought Japan and Germany in the war, right? They had, and they had lost fighters. They had sacrificed their blood, and therefore they were regarded as patriots and heroes, the way I suppose the Ho Chi Minh was. And they're up against people who actually were, there used to be a word, compradors, right? People who had accommodated Japan, were quite happy with Japan.
Yes, and you know, you said spilled their blood. I mean, the people who founded North Korea, and this was founded after the United States created the Republic of Korea or South Korea, and the people who founded that were guerrillas who had spent about 12 years fighting the Japanese within Manchuria and fighting them in order to liberate Korea from Japanese rule. And the Soviets were also instrumental in defeating the Japanese because the Soviets entered the war, I think, 3 months after the end of the war in Europe, which was an arrangement that Stalin had with Roosevelt. And they swept through Manchuria, and they swept through the northern half of Korea. So the Kim Il-sung, the founder of North Korea, said, you know, the guerrillas have spilled blood on behalf of Korea's liberation. The Soviets have spilled blood on behalf of Korea's liberation. And the Americans haven't spilt one drop of blood. They didn't arrive until a month after. Mm-hmm. Japanese had surrendered. I mean, according to...
Yeah, a victory parade wouldn't be terribly impressive.
No. So in their view, the United States had no right to be on the peninsula. Mm-hmm. However, the Soviets had made that arrangement.
You know, Stephen, you probably remember, I do, that it used to be a little, practically a sing-song rhyme system that the Americans had. Oh, when will the Soviets ever go home? They're occupying everybody. They never leave. Well, they did leave Korea, and China left Korea, but the United States is still there. Even Jimmy Carter had problems with that one, by the way. You remember?
Yes, they never left. They arrived in 1945, in the summer of 1945. The Soviets were there as well, a month before. The Soviets were asked to leave after the DPRK was established, and they did by December of 1948, at which point the United States started talking about, well, it seems kind of embarrassing that we're still here. Maybe we're going to have to leave. There's a declassified CIA report that's available online that you can look at, in which the CIA starts talking about what's going to happen if we actually withdraw our combat troops. This isn't going to work out very well, because if we do, I mean, this puppet regime that we've established is going to be overthrown. So there was this reluctance.
By the way, I hope that's in your book. I assume that you you will share with us what you found.
Yes. So there was a reluctance to withdraw the troops, but they were, however, the United States left 500 advisors behind, which were integrated with the Korean military, essentially commanding the Korean military. So the U.S. military presence on the peninsula has been continuous since the summer of 1945.
Mm-hmm. This is Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com. The book. When is the book coming out, by the way?
April of 2018.
Well, you're going to have to write a few articles in between, cribbing from the book. But this is just many, many people are waiting for this book. It's going to be the title will be Patriots, Traitors, and Empires: The Story of Korea's Fight for Freedom. What do you make of this present exchange? We have the president of the United States, but we're very much at the mercy, in my mind, of headline writers who give us headlines, for example, that say a war is inevitable. They says the North Korean representative. Is that what he said, or did he say maybe a little more than that?
And there's a news story that's just out recently in which the North Korean foreign minister is being portrayed as saying, indeed, that war is inevitable. But others are saying that what he's saying is that if the United States can threaten preemptive military action, then so can North Korea. And this is because the foreign minister had said that if the United States, that essentially the United States had declared war on North Korea, and that if the United States wants to fly B-2 bombers, or the B-1 bombers, have them prowl along the North Korean airspace, as they did years ago, that the North Koreans would regard this as an act of war and would attack. Mm-hmm. Even if these bombers were still outside of North Korean airspace.
Yeah. Well, they're flying north of the famous parallel, 38th, which is a highly provocative thing to do, is it not? I even saw on CNN today American commentators, former military people, raising their eyebrows about this because when you do something like that with a warplane and it breaks precedent, bad things can happen because you're only playing on your side of the field. The other guy has to make up his mind what he thinks of that.
Yes. I know. It's very provocative, but, I mean, the United States does very provocative things. Yeah. And you know, much comment has been made about Trump and the provocative comments he's been making. Mm-hmm. But with Trump, you know, the substance of what he says is never as much of an issue as how he says it, because much of what he says has been said many times before by other U.S. leaders. But somehow people don't get as upset when others say it. But the others have said essentially the same thing. For example, Wesley Clark. Wesley Clark had said that if the North Koreans ever attack South Korea, their nation would be completely destroyed. It would literally cease to exist. And that's simply for Koreans.
I remember him. He was Michael Moore's choice to run for the president of the Democratic Party.
Yes.
See, a moderate. That's the definition of moderate. Go ahead.
Clinton had said exactly the same thing in 1993. He said, you know, the North Koreans don't need nuclear weapons because, you know, if they ever use them, their country would no longer exist.
Yeah. Doubled down, of course, saying same about Iran, right? I mean,
yeah.
Iran is a country of 70 million people, so it would cease to exist.
Yes, I believe Hillary Clinton said that, yes.
Yeah.
And Colin Powell had said that North Korea could be reduced to a charcoal briquette. So, you know, these threats of entire annihilation of a country have been made on numerous occasions. And we think about Wesley Clark. Usually they're made in connection with an invasion. You know, if North Korea attacks South Korea, we're going to drop nuclear weapons on them. which one could argue is certainly a very disproportionate.
By the way, that language has been precluded by international law, the United Nations and others, right? You're not supposed to threaten. It's not just force, but to threaten massive force of that kind, particularly nuclear. That's supposed to be verboten, prohibited language.
Exactly. And yet the United States has done it over and over and over again with the North Koreans, and that's one of the reasons the North Koreans say they need nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm. Well, you notice that Trump, and you're quite right, not any different than Obama and Bush and all the others, they really misrepresent the issues when they arise. For example, Trump is saying, well, we're very grateful to China and Russia for voting for this resolution. But the Chinese and the Russians have been very clear in saying that U.S. should cease its provocative actions along the border so that North Korea could then back up from the decision to go forward with nuclear weapons. Am I right?
Yeah. And I mean, this is often presented as the North Korean problem. And what's the solution to the North Korean problem? But I'm not sure what the problem is. But if we accept that there's a problem, I know the Chinese and Russians have said, well, Washington says to us, we're not doing enough to solve this problem. But what is Washington doing to solve the problem? Mm-hmm. It's exacerbating the problem. What it could be doing to solve the problem is perhaps looking at the proposal that the North Koreans have made, but now has been attributed to others, like the South Koreans and the Chinese. And that proposal was that North Koreans will freeze the development of their nuclear weapons, will stop ballistic missile testing in exchange for the United States agreeing to freeze its provocative war games on the peninsula, which are carried out every year. These are the largest war games in the world,
yes,
involving hundreds of thousands of troops, yes, and they do them every year over and over and over again.
Well, and provocative actions, you've told us in the past that they take warplanes with dummy bombs and then drop the dummy bombs close to the border.
And they deliberately fly during the day.
Yeah, I mean,
sure that the North Koreans can see them.
Yeah. At the core of this, part of the core, admitting, I guess, aspects to it, but is it not that there was a war from 50 to 53, and it was, the Americans called it a police action, one of the weirdest terms anybody ever developed. There is a ceasefire, but no peace agreement. Is the problem in getting a peace agreement that the United States does not want to acknowledge the sovereignty of North Korea? What is the problem?
I think ultimately the problem is that the United States absolutely does not want to lose the Korean Peninsula as an extension of the Pentagon. It doesn't want to have to take its troops off the peninsula because its troops having a presence on the peninsula is very beneficial to the Pentagon as a way of balancing or checking China and Russia, which is the real concern. The North Koreans have, on many occasions, made a proposal for reunification. And it's a very reasonable proposal. And the proposal is that a confederal system be developed. So they have one nation, one flag, one country, but they have two systems. Mm-hmm. So in the north, you'd have kind of like a provincial government, which would have a communist system, and in the south you'd have another provincial government which would have a capitalist system, and then you'd have an overarching federal government which would look after self-defense and foreign affairs.
Mm-hmm.
Very reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
But it's never gone ahead, and the reason it hasn't gone ahead is because of one stipulation that the North Koreans make, and that is there can be no U.S. troops in Korea. And the South Koreans always reject it on those grounds. And the South Korean proposal for reunification insists on maintaining U.S. military presence in Korea.
Wow. Yes. We're speaking to Stephen Gowans, and the book is Patriots, Traitors, and Empires. You could probably order it now. The Story of Korea's Fight for Freedom. And Stephen, lastly, everybody leaves out the fact the South Koreans elected somebody who's not such a hardliner, and nobody ever quotes him, and nobody even actually quotes the South Koreans. All we hear is Trump. And if there is a decision to be made about whether or not there will be a confrontation from the point of view of Seoul and Washington, it's actually Washington, is it not, that would make all the decisions? Kind of like Canada.
Yes, Washington would make all the decisions. The Japanese in Manchuria established a state called Manchukuo, which is always called a puppet state. Always. It's always the puppet state of. And as I was researching this, it occurred to me that South Korea, the Republic of Korea, is just as much a puppet state as Manchukuo was. And some historians have even made the point that, you know, the real powers within the Republic of Korea, South Korea, are the U.S. commander who commands the ROK forces, the U.S. ambassador, and the CIA station chief. In fact, at certain points, some of the presidents of South Korea have spent most of their time simply responding to those three people who have really wielded enormous power in South Korea. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure it really matters what the South Korean president thinks. In fact, just recently, the South Korean president was meeting with his military and saying, you know, at what point are we going to take control of our own military? Because, you know, we're not threatened by the North Koreans, he said. Look at our budget. Our military budget is four times higher than theirs. We have twice the population. Therefore, we can field twice the number of soldiers, troops. We have 700,000 troops. We have 3.5, that's active duty. We have 3.5 million in reserve. The North Koreans are completely outclassed. So at what point are we going to take control of our own military? Because the generals always say, well, we can't because, you know, we can't defend ourselves. And despite that, despite his complaint, the Americans aren't going anywhere.
He probably came within a hair's breadth of being arrested. Stephen, it's been great talking to you. It's very informative. We need your writing on at gowans.wordpress.com. Look forward to talking to you again.
Okay, thanks, Phil.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye. Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Phil, there's going to be some meetings, events.
There is an event on Saturday, September 30th. That's this coming Saturday at a different book list cultural center at 777 Bathurst Street. And it's a book launch called Why Don't the Poor Rise Up by Jamu Nangwaya and Michael Trussello. And our friend Ajumo Baraka had this to say about it. He said, combining the most creative thought from the global north and south, Why Don't the Poor Rise Up promises to be an indispensable resource for understanding why the new revolutionary movement of the 21st century will emerge from the ranks of the most marginalized by capitalism and colonialism.
So that's an event is what, where?
Saturday, September 30th at 6:30 p.m. to 9 p.m. at a different book list, 779 Bathurst Street.
Okay. By the way, you can write to us or follow us. Did I say? Yeah, you can even write to us. Facebook.com/TheTaylorReport. And Phil, there's also
SoundCloud.com/Taylor-Report.
Thank you. And we hope you will follow us there and listen to the broadcasts of previous, like guys like Gowans, that you really need to know about. I think we will take a little musical break. Is it going to be Lead Belly? Oh, great. Okay, this is Taylor Report. We'll be right back.